This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joining us for a return visit to Fresh Air is writer Paul Auster. His novels include The Book of Illusions, Timbuktu, and Leviathan. He wrote the screenplays for the films Smoke, Blue in the Face, and Lulu on the Bridge. Many NPR listeners know him as the editor and on-air voice of NPR's National Story Project. The companion book, I Thought My Father Was God, was a bestseller. Auster's novels typically contain stories within stories, and his new novel, Oracle Night, is no exception. It's about a writer recovering from a debilitating illness who lacks the energy and focus for nearly everything, including writing. But on a visit to a stationery store in his Brooklyn neighborhood, he buys a blue notebook that seems to magically inspire him. The stories he writes take on an odd and inexplicable connection to his actual life. Paul Auster, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, the last time we spoke was in September of 2002, and that interview ended on a kind of dramatic note. We were running out of time, and just as we were running out of time, we were talking a little bit about how you had reached that stage in life where many people you know and who you had been close to had died, and you were discussing how it affected you. And then you said something that I didn't have time to ask you about because we ran out of time. Let me play back what you said.
I'm not really gloomy about it at all.
Why not?
I'm just trying to get the most out of the time that's left to me. I hope it's still many years, but I can't bank on that at all. And every day becomes more precious than the one before. And, you know, there's this great desire to do the work that I feel I have it in me still to do and to, you know, take care of the people I love as best I can and to just appreciate the miracle of being alive. Just a month ago, my wife, daughter, and I were in a horrific car accident, and the car was demolished. We were blindsided by a speeding van not far from our house in Brooklyn, and the impact of that collision, you know, is still with me, you know, reverberating through my body. It was a nightmare experience, and we should be dead, and when I saw the car afterwards, I don't know how we got out of there alive. You know, we should be dead, but we're not. And it's just another reminder about how things can change in an instant, how precarious and unpredictable life is. And it's just reminded me all over again that I'm just so lucky to be breathing still. And I want to go on breathing as long as I can.
Well, Paul, that's where our interview ended in September of 2002, because the clock ran out.
The clock ran out. Boy, do I remember that well. I mean, just hearing myself talk about the accident brings it all back, as if it were yesterday.
But this is what I've been wondering. You know, one would like to think that when you survive a car crash like that, and you see your life in a different way, that stays with you, and that life gains this new sense of preciousness, which you retain and continue to retain. But how long did that perspective actually last, that constant sense of the preciousness and also the precariousness of life?
I think it hasn't gone away because since I talked to you last time, all kinds of other near misses have taken place.
Oh, no.
just about 2 months ago, maybe 3 months ago, I guess it was October, when it was starting to get cold here in New York, I turned on the heating system in our house, which is natural gas, is a boiler down in the cellar. And everything seemed to be working. The heat was coming through the pipes. And somewhere around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I smelled something very funny in the house. I was upstairs. I went down. And the entire bottom floor was filled with smoke. I went down into the basement, completely blinded by smoke. And the boiler had burst into flame. And I didn't know what to do. I ran upstairs. I found a bucket, and I just doused the fire, and you know, turned off the gas. If I had been out walking the dog, say at that moment, I think the whole house would have burned down. And the smell of that burning steam pipe was in the house for days after. And again, I how many lives do we get? 9, right?
Those are the pussycats.
I know. I think I'm using my number pretty quickly.
Well, you know, death is hovering in the background throughout your new book. And, you know, so is the precarious and unpredictable nature of life. It's constantly acknowledged. And I'm assuming that comes from these close calls that you have in your life.
I'm trying in my fiction really to present the kind of world that I feel I live in, and to be as faithful to that reality as I can. And it does come out of experience. Everything is transformed, of course, but it's out of the guts, you know. It's not some philosophical proposition. It's really about experience.
And of course, different characters react to this type of thing in different ways. And, you know, I'm even wondering, like, after the car crash, your whole family was in this car. Did you find that everybody in the family had a different experience of the car crash and that it changed their life in different ways? You know, for instance, I'm thinking it's the kind of thing that can give you this sense of renewal. Like, well, I lived through this, so now I'm kind of free to do anything.
Well,
or it can paralyze you out of fear, yes, that it could happen again.
Well, I can tell you that each one of the three of us has had a different response, I guess. Our daughter, who is now 16, so I guess she was 15 then, was asleep in the back seat without a seatbelt on, but lying on a quilt with pillows. And I don't think she really experienced the accident because she was asleep. It was just a big jolt, and she was fine. Whereas my wife, Siri, who was in the passenger seat in the front, she took the brunt of the impact, and they had to cut the door with a torch to get her out of there. And at first I thought her neck was broken. She couldn't move, and we were taken to the hospital, and she went through x number of tests and x-rays and MRIs, and finally nothing was broken. She, I think, has been rather scared to be in cars ever since. And I myself have been very reluctant to drive. We don't own a car. That happened to have been a rented car. And I've only driven a few times since then. So I don't think it was a liberating experience, more of a bad memory.
So outside of being afraid to drive a car, is there anything else that the crash has either made you afraid to do or has kind of inspired or encouraged you to do that you wouldn't have done before?
Huh, that's a very good question. I don't really think so. I've been very, very faithful about putting on my seatbelt, I have to say, whenever I am in a car. And every time we go past the spot where the accident took place, you know, I look at the light pole where our car spun around and smashed into, which has a big dent in it. So there are still visible traces of the accident in the world, and I think about it. I think about it a lot. But again, as I said a year and a half ago on the radio, so lucky. That's really ultimately how I feel, so lucky that it wasn't worse.
Right. Now, you are a storyteller. Is the story of the accident something that you tell a lot to other people, or would you just as soon not go there very often?
It's come up a few times in conversation, but I don't go around broadcasting it to people. It's really, finally, a very dull story. Lots of people have been in car accidents, and it's something private more than public, I think. It came up when we were talking last time in the context of how unpredictable the world is, and I guess it just was a further reminder to me of how precarious things are.
Now, because you are a professional storyteller, I'm going to ask you, what exactly is boring about that story?
Boring in the sense that there's nothing original about it. There's nothing new to be said about a car crash.
Mm-hmm.
They happen every day. Tens of thousands of people die every year from these kinds of accidents. And there's nothing new about it. It's just terrible. But terrible in a private way, the way so much of our lives are led. I mean, people go through divorces, and it's painful. But to talk about divorce is somewhat boring. People lose loved ones to death or illness, and again, there's something not terribly interesting about it, in the abstract, in any case. That's all I mean.
My guest is writer Paul Auster. His new novel is called Oracle Night. There's something I'd like you to read from your new novel, Oracle Night. And I think this relates to what we're talking about very directly, the sense that life can be changed in an instant. And I'm going to ask you to introduce this reading for us, to set it up and put it in context.
All right. There are two writers in this novel. The narrator, Sidney Orr, is 34 years old. And then there's an older writer, John Trowse, who's in his mid-50s. And they're good friends. And at one point, they're discussing various writers. And Trowse says, you know, there's this little episode in The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett, which would be a great premise for a novel if someone, you know, could figure out how to make a story out of it. And so that's what Sidney is thinking about when he writes this passage on page 13. He was referring to the Flitcraft episode in the 7th chapter of The Maltese Falcon. The curious parable that Sam Spade tells Bridget O'Shaughnessy about the man who walks away from his life and disappears. Flitcraft is a thoroughly conventional fellow, a husband, a father, a successful businessman, a person without a thing to complain about. One afternoon, as he's walking to lunch, a beam falls from a construction site on the 10th floor of a building and nearly lands on his head. Another inch or two and Flitcraft would have been crushed, but the beam misses him. And except for a little chip of sidewalk that flies up and hits him in the face, he walks away unhurt. Still, the close call rattles him, and he can't push the incident from his mind. As Hammett puts it, quote, he felt like somebody had taken the lid off life and let him look at the works, unquote. Flitcraft realizes that the world isn't the sane and orderly place he thought it was, that he's had it all wrong from the beginning and never understood the first thing about it. The world is governed by chance. Randomness stalks us every day of our lives, and those lives can be taken from us at any moment for no reason at all. By the time Flitcraft finishes his lunch, he concludes that he has no choice but to submit to this destructive power, to smash his life through some meaningless, wholly arbitrary act of self-negation. He will fight fire with fire, as it were, and without bothering to return home or say goodbye to his family, without even bothering to withdraw any money from the bank, he stands up from the table, goes to another city, and starts his life all over again.
That's Paul Auster reading from his new novel, Oracle Night. Paul, what made you think about that passage?
Well, it's interesting. This idea was planted in my head many years ago, probably in the late 80s, early 90s, when I got to know the filmmaker Wim Wenders, the mm-hmm. German filmmaker. And we had an idea at that time to make a film together. And it was Wim's suggestion that we do the Flitcraft story. He said, it's so fascinating. It'd be such an interesting premise for a film. And I started thinking about it then. That's when I invented Nick Bowen, this character within the novel within the novel, so to speak, has been with me for 13 or 14 years. And unfortunately, the project with Wim never worked out. We never could get the money for the film. But it stayed with me, and I always knew that I wanted to reanimate it somehow in a novel, and I finally done it.
Now, the writer in this book has been very sick, and he's lost, at the beginning of the book, he's lost all interest in writing. And it's not until he buys a blue notebook, a notebook that seems to have magical power, that he starts writing again. It's as if this notebook gives him the power to... Mm-hmm. Stories just flow out of him once he has it. You wish, right?
Yeah, I wish, right? But you know, it's Sidney is a little unstable, mm-hmm. mentally and physically, mm-hmm. even during... He's recovered from a near-fatal illness, but he's still pretty shaky. And so... What's objectively true and subjectively true are very murky. The line between what's going on outside him and inside him is very fuzzy. And the book is about, I think, uncertainty in some way. So it's just a notebook. But he suddenly gets it into his head that it has some kind of magical property, or at least for a little while. And once you believe something, in some sense it becomes true, doesn't it?
Well, you give the thing that power.
Exactly.
He says, words rushed out of me as though I were taking dictation, transcribing sentences from a voice that spoke in the crystalline language of dreams, nightmares, and unfettered thoughts. Do you ever feel, when you are writing, that that is happening, that words, that you're just taking dictation?
Sometimes. But it's rare. Usually I'm struggling along very slowly to get it right. And then every once in a while there'll be an hour or a day or 20 minutes in which there's this rush and it all comes out just perfectly. I'm reminded of the beautiful phrase by the painter Philip Guston, someone whose work I admire a lot. Years and years of struggle, he said, for a few moments of grace. And I think most artists experience that at one time or another. You're just drilling and drilling and with your pickaxe, and it's very difficult. And then suddenly you reach a moment where it's all just flowing, and you can't explain why that should be.
You seem to be someone who is just filled with stories. I mean, even like your novels, they have stories within stories. So it's not just one story.
No, they're bouncing off of each other.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in, I don't know what you might call the magnetic field that is created by rubbing two stories against each other and the kind of sparks that are emitted and the way it can lead to reflection and questioning on the part of the reader. It's almost what you might call a kind of the effect of collage, I think, where if you have several elements interacting with one another, something interesting is bound to happen. Some new entity is created that's greater than the sum of the parts.
Did you actually study deconstruction theory, deconstructionist theory?
No, not at all. No, I never read any of those works.
So this isn't like an academic concept for you. It's something,
no.
Right?
No, it's all instinct. It's all intuitive. I know people think I know about all these things, but I don't. I've never read any of those books. Once I tried to read Derrida, and I think I got three pages in and I stopped. I didn't understand a word I was reading.
Right. Very, very academic language. Well, you seem to have so many stories that naturally come to you, and in the writing process, is the construction of the stories filled with effort, or is it just the language itself that's the really difficult part?
It's the language. It is true. I see these characters, I see these situations very clearly in my mind, and it just the effort in writing the book is to express them as clearly and as efficiently and as beautifully as I can. And that's where the real work comes in, you know, the prose.